Welcome to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. I'm Russ White. At 6 past 4 following news, Kirk Heinze talks with former Grand Rapids Mayor George Hartwell.
In cities, the river's going to flood. There's going to be a heat wave and people are going to be at risk. There's going to be a hurricane or a tornado. We deal with the real issues at the ground level in cities all over the world. And so we don't have the luxury of debating philosophy around this. We got to get stuff done.
Hartwell also looks back on his legacy as one of America's greenest mayors.
The challenges right now for Grand Rapids and for the decade to come are going to be around managing growth well. This is an attractive place to be. People want to be in Grand Rapids.
Kirk Heinze talks with George Hartwell at 4:06.
This is Greening of the Great Lakes, inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's a great pleasure to welcome back to the show former Grand Rapids Mayor George Hartwell, who just stepped away from the helm a few days ago, and who capped his 11-year tenure in style by attending the Paris Climate Summit. We're going to get his reactions to the landmark agreement and some reflections on his tenure as mayor. George, I always appreciate you taking the time to come on the program.
Well, thank you, Kirk. You may be the very first one to have introduced me as the former mayor of Grand Rapids. It sounds a little strange to me, but it's the truth. After 12 years as mayor of Grand Rapids, the end of last month, I hung up my spurs, and I'm now a civilian. So if that isn't mixing with a bunch of metaphors.
Well, it does. It sounds a little odd to say, but I said 11 years. I should have said 12 years in the saddle as mayor. But just back from Paris, what an amazing experience that was. There weren't a lot of mayors in Paris. I know that you were among a rather small group of mayors. But your reactions overall, and then we'll drill down into some of the specifics.
Well, sure. There were, in fact, ended up with 37 U.S. mayors who were there, and a total of something well north of 400 international mayors who were in Paris. It was just a phenomenal experience for me. I attended COP19 in Warsaw 2 years ago, and so I went with, perhaps out of that experience, some diminished expectations. That was a very disappointing climate conference, as you'll recall. This one, the atmosphere was just electric around it. We as mayors felt we were there with a specific role to try to influence and push our own national delegations. In our case, our U.S. delegation, we had the opportunity as a smaller group of mayors, about eight of us, that met with our negotiating team, our State Department diplomats, both to receive reports from them on what was going on in the, in the cloistered area where only the diplomats were allowed, and at the same time to be able to send our message into them, what we feel is important and what we wanted them to emphasize and where they were hung up to give them encouragement to be bold and move forward.
You mentioned an electric environment, an electric milieu. What do you think has changed between Warsaw and Paris to create that sort of excitement and ultimately the agreement that came out of Paris?
Well, one thing, just to pick an obvious example to cities, was that we went into Warsaw, that is the international community of cities, with a very strong statement that we wanted incorporated into the final document. That statement survived the first week of negotiations. The mid-level diplomats were content to live with it. And then the big boys got to town and they scratched it. And it was scratched, I think, in part because the U.S. Department, State Department, didn't want to alienate the Chinese, and the Chinese relationship with their cities is very different and less positive than the U.S. State Department's relationship with our cities. So coming into this one, we knew, though, that China had moved a long way. You saw that with the U.S.-China accords that had been reached just in advance of the conference. We knew that cities were going to have a strong role. Former Mayor Michael Bloomberg of New York and Mayor Anne Hidalgo of Paris convened all the mayors of the world that were there for a day at City Hall, and which we listened to President Hollande of France. We heard from Leonardo DiCaprio and Robert Redford and Al Gore and a host of others that have been deeply involved in this in environmental issues at a very highly visible place. And so I think what was different for me was the seriousness with which we were treated, the respect that cities were given in the process, and then the fact that the French had insisted that when everybody came this time to this COP, this Conference of the Partners in Paris, that they would put on the table before they got there their goals. That had never been done before in 22 years. Countries had not set their aspirations out. And so going in, we knew where 195 nations had set their targets for improving and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. That was a starting point like we haven't had before, and they could only go up from there, I would say.
We're talking about the Paris Climate Conference with former Grand Rapids Mayor George Hartwell, who was there. Talk a little bit about some environmentalist reaction, while positive, has been cautiously optimistic. Some of these things in the agreement are legally mandated, but there are other things that are not. Could you give our listeners some idea of what is mandated and what is essentially voluntary?
Well, I don't have a good list at hand, Kirk, but here's what I would say. The agreement, if fully implemented and when fully implemented, will achieve a significant slowdown in the rate of global temperature increases through the reduction of greenhouse gases. It doesn't quite hit the target we need to hit in order to avoid what will ultimately be a cataclysmic event, or maybe it's simply that the world gets snuffed out like a candle. But in one way or the other, this doesn't quite do it. But it's stronger than anything we've had before, and so what environmentalists are concerned about is some of the non-binding nature of it. It's great on transparency. It's weak on accountability. So everybody has to report. They're mandated to report their progress against the goals that they established, that they set out for themselves. But there's no binding nature to the agreement. There's no punitive aspects if they don't achieve. So it's sort of a best effort to accomplish this goal. Here's where I have confidence. In spite of the fact that we have a non-binding agreement, in spite of the fact that it doesn't achieve the goal we need to meet, cities are committed to greenhouse gas reduction. So I come back from Paris, and I got home on a Saturday. The following Monday, I was able to announce here in Grand Rapids that we are the 11th city in the nation to achieve what's called the 2030 Energy District Challenge. That is, we have over 10 million square feet of office space that's committed to carbon neutrality by the year 2030. And the very next day at the city commission meeting, the commission unanimously approved a contract for a 38-acre, 3-megawatt solar energy display at our former Butterworth landfill site. On the same agenda was the relamping of all of the streetlights, 17,500 of them in Grand Rapids, for LED lighting. And while that wasn't approved, it was set over to the next meeting. The only reason was some questions about the financing and not whether we should do it or not. So cities are doing things that I believe, well, when the first 5-year evaluation of the Paris Accords is made, I'm convinced that these diplomats are going to look at the data and they're going to say, "Damn, look what happened. The cities exceeded anything we thought was possible," because the commitment of cities all over this globe is nothing short of phenomenal.
That's interesting. I'm talking with former Grand Rapids Mayor George Hartwell about the Paris Accords, but you anticipated my next question. Cities have been on the front edge, including Grand Rapids. You mentioned Michael Bloomberg in New York. We've talked to some other mayors. Mayors have been on the front edge of sustainability for a long time now. So the fact that you've been treated with such respect in Paris, the fact that you're very optimistic about this agreement, I mean, it must mean that that perception of cities that has been evolving and the importance of what cities has been doing has been embraced by diplomats and by heads of state.
Well, I think finally the message sunk in. I mean, diplomats, international diplomats, and national legislative bodies can debate political ideology and philosophy and even science of climate change until the cows come home. But in cities, the river's going to flood. There's going to be a heat wave and people are going to be at risk. There's going to be a hurricane or a tornado. We deal with the real issues at the ground level in cities all over the world. And so we don't have the luxury of debating philosophy around this. We got to get stuff done. And so cities, you're absolutely right. As the impacts of climate change have been felt and understood in cities in this country and all over the globe, mayors, city councils have been addressing the issue now for the last 2 decades.
One part of the agreement, and it sort of speaks to what we've been talking about, some of the smaller island nations and the lesser developed nations are quite concerned not only about the temperature thresholds that were set, but also about where they're going to get the money to do some of the things that the more developed nations can do. There's a $1 billion figure that was tossed around to provide some of these lesser developed countries with the wherewithal to do some things. But that, again, is not mandated. That's going to be voluntary. How do you see that happening?
Right. Well, and let me correct the number, Kirk, and that is $100 billion a year that the developed nations have pledged to the developing nations to allow them to do some of the leapfrog technologies that will help get them to where they need to be. So a small developing nation, for example, is faced with needing to put additional electric energy production facilities online, and they look at the cost of coal and they say, you know, that makes the most sense given our economy, our growing economy here. But they could go to the fund and they could borrow from the fund or get grants from the fund, depending on how it's set up, to leapfrog coal technology and go directly to a more renewable form of energy, a more expensive investment, but a more renewable form. So, but you're right, there's no guarantees. I mean, President Hollande of France stood up in front of all of us mayors, and he had already pledged France to $2 billion a year. He stood up in front of us and he said, "That's not enough. $5 billion. Now, President Obama has to come back and sell that to Congress. And we know how Congress has been responding over and over to President Obama's initiative. So I'm nervous about where, you know, this great nation will come down when it comes to ponying up our share for that fund.
Yeah, the last thing we want to be is an outlier when you've got 195 nations or so that have signed an accord, and then we come back. It would remind you of what happened with Woodrow Wilson back in the League of Nations.
Yes, indeed, or what happened with George W. Bush and the Kyoto Accords.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
And you're listening to a conversation between Kirk Heinze and former Grand Rapids Mayor George Hartwell.
Well, our guest is George Hartwell. George is the former mayor of Grand Rapids. He served as mayor for 12 years, just stepped down at the end of 2015. George, we've been talking about Paris, and we've been talking about the accord, the historic accord that was signed in Paris. Let's bring it back home to Grand Rapids. As you look back over your 12 years when you started here, a lot of initiatives in this city, a lot of cutting-edge technologies, a lot of research, a lot of doing things, a lot of grassroots support. What do you feel best about or most proud of as you look back, over, particularly on the sustainability front?
You know, Kirk, I was fortunate enough to come into this office, I think, at this wonderful pregnant moment in history when suddenly people were becoming aware of this thing called climate change. Global warming was the term we used at the time, and it's descriptive, and climate change is even more accurate, I think, and more descriptive. And I had done enough reading to be dangerous, and I decided that this was something that I needed to pay attention to in my city if I was going to be a good mayor, if I was going to leave a city that would be sustainable for generations to come, that I better start paying attention to this phenomena of climate change. What that meant was it put me out on the cutting edge, sometimes the bleeding edge of the climate change movement. It wasn't necessarily well received here in Grand Rapids in those early days, but there was a sort of a support group, if you will, of business leaders here that had formed the West Michigan Sustainable Business Forum, and they surrounded me and they said, you know, this isn't just a crazy environmentalist. This guy knows what he's talking about, and we're supporting him and we're with him, and so together we began to make an impact in Grand Rapids. What am I most proud of? I think if it's hard to put the finger on any one initiative and say that's the one I'm most proud of. I would say it is the incredible shift in the culture and the understanding in this community that's taken place over 12 years from a passive aggressive resistance to the kinds of things that I was talking about to fully embracing it. Now, that's not to say there aren't still critics and climate deniers and others out there, but this community has embraced the initiatives around energy and energy conservation and water conservation and public transportation like no time else in our history. And so if my buttons my chest swells and my buttons pop, it's because I'm so proud of what we've accomplished, the distance we've come as a city in terms of our understanding and acceptance of our role as a city in this global problem.
George, you brought a background, religion background. You're a member of the clergy to the job of mayor as well. You've always been big on social justice, but you've also integrated that in the whole ethos of sustainability here in Grand Rapids. I mean, we mentioned environment, we mentioned economic sustainability, but you've also looked at this whole business of social justice and where that fits in. I'll talk a little bit about that and why that's so important.
When I talk about the sustainability and the triple bottom line of environment and equity and economy, I talk about it as a room with three doors, and the door that I came through was the social equity door, was the social justice door, if you will. A career working with the homeless community here in Grand Rapids, a background in racial equity work both at the state and national level, had sort of position me, I think, to be strong as a mayor coming into this sustainability room through the social justice portal. Once you're in the room, you find that the three elements of the triple bottom line work together well, and when they do, it's powerful. So the very things that are good for people are almost always going to be good for the environment and help you grow and thrive as an economic entity here in this city. So we work on the Grand River and cleaning up the waters of the Grand River, for an example, separating our combined sewers, a $400 million project over 20 years, but it makes for a healthier community. It makes for a community. It makes for economic opportunity around the river, recreational opportunity, development opportunity, and it makes for a more content and satisfied population. People that feel better about themselves because they're in harmony somehow with this natural element. Hard to put that into words for me. It has a spiritual dimension to it. But I think that's an example of a triple bottom line that works powerfully at all three levels.
I know that we may have an occasion to talk again because you're going to be continue to be involved in some major sustainability and environmental issues. But as your successor comes into office, and at some point we'd like an opportunity to meet your successor, what are some of the challenges that remain that individual is going to have to deal with?
Right. Well, Mayor Rosalind Bliss, having taken office January 1st, is the brings with her the dual advantages of experience as a Grand Rapids City Commissioner for 10 years and youth. She turned 40 years old on the day after she was elected mayor of Grand Rapids. She's smart. She's strategic. She can be tough when she needs to be tough, and yet she's got a heart of compassion as well. And so I couldn't be happier with a successor. Rosalind Bliss is going to be a great mayor. She immediately faces some challenges. One of those is housing affordability in Grand Rapids. Right now, we have approximately a 50-50 mix of downtown housing opportunities that are market rate and affordable. Definition of affordable, being that they have some kind of an instrument that a tax credit or a subsidy that helps to reduce the cost to the renter. Roughly 50-50, but there are another 680 units coming on stream in 2016 that'll be available for rental. All 680 of those are market rate units. The cost of real estate, the cost of construction has gone up here. It's an attractive place to live and work, and people want to be here, and that drives prices up, and it makes it very difficult for affordable housing. Rosalind is also committed to continuing the energy initiatives that we've started here in Grand Rapids. She will oversee the relamping of 17,500 streetlights with LED structures. She will pull the switch on the first solar display, 38-acre solar display here in Grand Rapids, and probably will quickly thereafter move on the same site to the second 38 acres that's set aside already for another 3 megawatts of power. So I think the challenges right now for Grand Rapids and for the decade to come are going to be around growth and managing growth well. This is an attractive place to be. People want to be in Grand Rapids. And so managing that becomes a sort of an urban challenge for a mayor.
George, I'd be remiss. We've got about a minute left here. But you and your lovely wife, Sue, what are some of your plans going forward as you move out of the office of mayor? And, again, I know you're going to be involved in some other things, but any immediate plans besides going to Florida?
Well, yeah. So we're not really snowbirds, but we're going to take a couple weeks here later this month in Florida. But we have built our little retirement home on the Muskegon River, 30 acres and 1,400 and some feet of river frontage on a place that we have owned for 21 years and we just dearly love. But I'm not ready to just retire and fly fish, although I certainly want to do more of that. I've got a couple of very interesting opportunities in sustainability and in water quality that I'm going to be involved in, and maybe we'll get a chance to talk about those in the future.
Well, I certainly hope so, and congratulations on 12 years, 12 very successful years as mayor of Grand Rapids. I've known you for a long time, George. I have great admiration for you, and I always appreciate your time coming on the program.
Thank you so much, Kirk.
That was Kirk Heinze talking with former Grand Rapids Mayor George Hartwell.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. There's more online at mlive.com/environment.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. With all the details now on MSU's 2016 MLK Day celebration plans, here's Jennifer Orlando.
Looking for a way to kick off 2016? I have an idea for you. How about the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Commemorative Celebration, January 17th and 18th here at MSU? Started in 1980, the commemorative celebration features a variety of events in which the MSU and Greater Lansing communities are encouraged to participate. Here to talk about what's planned for the 2016 celebration, its theme, If Not Now, Then When, If Not Us, Then Who, is Ignacio Andrade, Community Outreach Coordinator and Student Liaison at the Office for Inclusion and Intercultural Initiatives. Thank you for joining us, Ignacio.
All right. Well, thank you for having me, Jennifer. I really look forward to communicating with you about what we have planned for.
So could you give us a brief history about the commemorative celebration and the importance of celebrating it?
The commemorative celebration was started back in 1980 here at MSU, so it has a long established history. Even prior to the MLK holiday becoming a national holiday, we were celebrating MLK in that spirit here at MSU, and we've been doing it strong ever since. This year promises to be not only a throwback to some of the early days about what we used to celebrate, where it originated from. It has traditionally grown from that tradition and has elevated to a new level. This year, we are featuring a host of campus activities across campus spanning days, including but not limited to community service projects, a march for justice, student leadership conference, museum exhibits and performances, films and discussions, just a whole list of community-oriented social justice initiatives.
So Project 6050 started in 2014, so it's still kind of going strong. The MLK commemorative celebration is kind of tied into that. Can you explain to us how that works?
Sure. Project 6050, for those that haven't heard of it, I'll give a brief recap, but it started last year as a one-year initiative, but it was so successful that the president and the community at large decided that we wanted to take it on for a second year into the future. And so it is designed to commemorate the 60-year anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education, desegregating schools in the U.S. as we know it, and the 50 is celebrating in reference to the 50-year anniversary of the passing of the Civil Rights Act, both watershed moments in our nation's history that are not only strong in their history for advocating for civil rights and advancing civil rights in this country, but also terribly relevant today in our day and time. So what we have started is kind of growing to incorporate not only MSU community, but the larger community. 6050 has had events all across the state of Michigan, over 200 events. Now we're up to almost 300 events, and tens of thousands of people have participated in events. So these events are designed to center around civil rights, human rights, social justice conversations, getting to know who's in your community and how to build relationships with those people. So they're not just strangers. They become part of your community at higher levels than they were before. And so then that allows the conversation to open up about how do we work together to improve our community today in the short term, but also in the long term as well. So Project 6050 is a natural fit with Dr. MLK commemorative celebration. And it looks as though that this year, this is our second year of 6050, but our 36th year of MLK celebrating this community, both look to have a long future in our particular campus community as well.
We're here with Ignacio Andrade. He's the Community Outreach Coordinator and Student Liaison at the Office for Inclusion and Intercultural Initiatives. He's talking to us about the 2016 Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Commemorative Celebration, which takes place here on campus January 17th and 18th. So for several years, MSU has hosted a student conference as part of the commemorative celebration, where it's invited current students and high school students to talk about social justice issues, leadership, and so on. So what can we expect from this year's conference, Ignacio?
This year's conference is something a little different than we've done in the past. We've tried a lot of different formats, and this year we are excited about this new format. This new format, it's kind of like a TED Talk, but better, if you will. And better meaning nothing talking bad about a TED Talk. I love TED Talks, but better in the sense of you're going to hear more voices of students in particular that represent our community, talking, discussing issues in a shortened format. So the format is Pachakacha or Pechakucha, depending on who you talk to. But Pachakacha is the style of presentation that is 20 slides each up with a picture image for 20 seconds each. And those are timed. So the slide ends and goes into the next one automatically. So if you're off in your timing, everyone will know. So it is a more concise way of presenting. This is beneficial for our students in developing this skill because no matter where they go after MSU, we know that they will be solid presenters in boardrooms all across the world, all across Michigan, and being able to make those powerful, impactful, short, concise presentations that really have impact on our communities in ways that only Spartans can do, really. I like to think of it in that context. So this year, the Pachakacha style format, we're going to have multiple presenters, and in between each presentation, all focusing on social justice, civil rights, human rights, as the students see it themselves. So it can be left, right, and center. Everyone is welcome. We have a variety of different topics and subjects that are going to be explored. And in between these presentations, we are actually going to engage as a community, the audience, in a discussion about those presentations through the lens of social justice generally. So it's going to be a lot of action, community engagement, powerful, impactful presentations all around subjects that are extremely important and relevant to MSU and really the greater nation and world as we speak about these issues nationally, especially. These are very relevant and timely issues.
Can you give us a little more detail about the conference in terms of, you know, who's invited, when it's happening, where it's happening?
Sure. The conference is Monday, January 18th. And it will be at 9 a.m. is the opening of the registration, and the Center for Service Learning is opening with on-site service projects as well as a community resource fair. And then it is opening once that 9 a.m. rolls by, it continues to flow into a film and discussion, and then the Pachakacha presentations, and then a community march, and then a community dinner. So everybody, these are all events are free and open to the public. The only thing that we ask is that you register in advance in order to secure a spot, both for the MLK Student Leadership Conference, for lunch, and then also for the community dinner for that evening on Monday, January 18th. And the entire community is invited, including students, staff, faculty, and off-campus community as well. Again, free, but you got to sign up as soon as possible to get yourself a spot. The event is taking place Monday, January 18th at the MSU Union, and the website to register is www.inclusion.msu.edu. It's open to all community members, and it's free.
Wonderful. So it sounds like a lot of events, you know, of course, are happening on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, which is that Monday, January 18th. But there are a couple of other events happening on Sunday, January 17th. Can you talk to us a little bit about what the community and the campus can expect on the 17th?
On the 17th, Sunday, January 17th, there are two shows, one at 3 p.m. and one at 7 p.m. This is put on in partnership with the College of Music here at MSU. The location is the Fairchild Theater at the MSU Auditorium. And the theme of this year, well, it always has a title of Jazz, Spirituals, Prayers, and Protests. But this year they have taken on a sub-theme, if you will, dealing with human trafficking. And so there is a 3 o'clock show and a 7 p.m. show. Tickets are free and available, but you just have to go to the website and bring – it'll give you details about that. So music.msu.edu, or you can go to inclusion.msu.edu and get more details about how to get your free tickets.
So another kind of annual event that happens every for the past 11 years, so this would be the 12th one happening on January 18th, is the community dinner, which is taking place at Hubbard Hall. Ignacio mentioned it earlier. And it's really great because it's free, it's open to the community, but this year it's taking on a special new twist. Can you give us some more detail, Ignacio?
This year, the community dinner has a special focus on highlighting for the annual MLK Endowed Scholarship Fund. These awardees will be honored at the dinner, and we will also be raising funds for next year's awardees. Our goal is to raise at least $30,000. So we're hoping that the community can come out and contribute both in person and online. And that information to both register for the dinner as well as contribute to the Student Scholarship Fund is all at inclusion.msu.edu.
Thank you so much for joining us today on the Spartan Podcast, Ignacio.
Thank you for having me. I especially wanted to say thanks to Spartan Podcast and CABS and yourself, Jennifer, for having us and organizing this to help us get the word out about this important community-wide event around a very important individual in our nation's history, Dr. MLK Jr. We look forward to having many more of these commemorative celebrations on this campus and in this community.
That was Ignacio Andrade, Community Outreach Coordinator and Student Liaison at the Office for Inclusion and Intercultural Initiatives. So for a complete list of everything going on during the 36th Annual Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Commemorative Celebration, visit inclusion.msu.edu. And good news, all the events are free for the community to attend unless otherwise noted. Martin Luther King Jr. Day is January 18th. Classes are canceled, but the university remains open. For MSU Today, I'm Jennifer Orlando.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today. Bob Scandaleras is a 1974 graduate of the MSU Broad College of Business. He's founded and served as CEO of several private and public companies and established Quantum Ventures of Michigan.
Quantum Ventures is a company that invests in companies around the United States, primarily right now in distribution and financial services and manufacturing. And we have historically also been involved in some high-tech startups, but right now we're not doing that. So it's just a boring company that spends a lot of its time looking at boring old industries where we can try to change things. We look at companies that, for whatever reason, aren't doing as well as they could do. And these are not turnarounds. They're not disasters, but they're companies where, you know, typically an 80-year-old or 70-year-old has run the company And it's a lifestyle company for him towards the end of his career. His sons are not willing to take it over. And when we get that, there's a lot of changes culturally that have to be made that would make the company stronger and better. So, you know, there's a real opportunity there to enhance the lives of the employees and create some wealth for people in the company.
Scandalaris is passionate about entrepreneurship.
Besides being an entrepreneur, you know, I look at the country, and if you go back to when I graduated, you know, we all wanted to work at IBM and Chrysler and GM and those kinds of companies, and they educated us for those jobs. And over the last probably 25 years, a lot of those jobs have been outsourced overseas, and it's a global world we're in. And so if you look where the jobs have been created, they've been in startups, they've been in technology companies, they've been places where we can compete not necessarily with $2 an hour, you know, wages that are in some places overseas, but where we can use the knowledge that's created by U.S. universities and benefit the world. And so the companies like Oracle and Microsoft and Apple, they didn't exist when I graduated, and that's who's been creating jobs. So I just think if we're going to make the U.S. a better place for our children and our grandchildren, we're going to have to find ways to enhance entrepreneurship in this country.
I asked Bob whether entrepreneurship is a skill one's born with, or can that skill set be learned and honed?
Well, there's a lot of debate about that. I think that the skills that you would use as an entrepreneur certainly can be trained, and universities are a good place to do that. And but whether or not you're a risk taker or an entrepreneur or want to be, you know, sort of this self-motivated person willing to take on the challenge of being an entrepreneur, I do believe some of that is you're born with it and it's a part of your DNA. 75% of entrepreneurs come from families where one or both parents were entrepreneurs. So there has to be some leanings that go that way, but it is not. I don't think you can take somebody that doesn't like taking risk and wants the stability of a job and make them comfortable as an entrepreneur.
Entrepreneurship skills go hand in hand with President Simon's T-shaped professional initiative.
One of the big words out there is entrepreneurship right now, and big companies are becoming more entrepreneurial so they can compete, because in the technology world, everything changes. It changes fast, and people respond to competitive changes quickly. So you have to be a little bit entrepreneurial, even if you work in big companies. And I think that you know, the skills that you can learn as an entrepreneur, even if you're not one, are really valuable as you go forward in your business career.
With this in mind, Bob's advice for today's young people is all about passion.
Well, for me, it's all about passion. So I still believe you have to find your passion. You have to find the place where you belong. And if you do that, you're going to enjoy what you do, and you're going to be better at what you do, and you're going to be willing to invest the time and energy that it takes to really hone your skills. So, you know, to me, it's just find that place where you have comfort and find the environment where you can really take those skills and talents and hone them. And if you do that, life will be good.
Scandalaris and his family give generously to MSU.
Well, there aren't too many places where you can give some money back to a cause and see the direct impact it has on the people that you most want to help. So you can give to cancer research, and certainly that's a worthy cause. But you know, when we feel like when we give to Michigan State, we can see the benefit it brings to the university and to the environment. And, you know, universities need the support of people out there, whether it's, you know, $100 or $10 million. It doesn't matter. Support, and they need that support.
Spartans win! Touchdown, MSU!
You know, I met Bob Scandalaris on the day that I was introduced as the head football coach at Michigan State.
That's Spartans head football coach Mark D'Antonio. Many know of Bob Scandalaris as his name is on the headquarters building for Spartan football.
On that day, he walked in and said, "I know you have this, I know you have that, but what do you need? What else do you need? What else can I do?" And since that time, he has been extremely supportive in every aspect.
There's no question Bob Scandalaris has put his mark on Michigan State.
Coach Izzo concurs with Coach D.
He's been a great guy. He's been a guy that texts you when you're down. He calls you. He's been a guy that He's here for you, and he's here financially, but he's here in body too. You know, he's at our events, he's at our games. He's on the road.
Bob Scandalaris is co-chairing MSU's Empower Extraordinary Capital campaign with Dee Cook.
There are two women in my life that inspire me. One's my wife, and the other's Dee Cook. So, you know, I think that, you know, the university needs money, obviously, for scholarships. You know, there's a lot of talk about the gap between the rich and the poor. Education should not fall into that gap. Education should just be if you're talented enough and desirous of going to a top university, we should make it available to you. So we have to figure out how to do that. Professors, we need to keep the best professors at Michigan State. So if that means we have to support their research, that's important. Facilities, you know, they get old. And as they get old, they need to be replaced. And the technology changes that have taken place, a lot of the older buildings have to be updated. So there are a myriad of reasons why you would give, and where you would give depends on where your passion is. But if we're going to take MSU and 100 years from now look back and say, what a great university, we're going to have the support of a lot of people. And we've got 500,000 alumni, and you know, they love Michigan State. So it's just a matter of getting that group to really start throwing in support. And they are. This campaign's been very successful to date. So we're very proud of what the university's been able to do.
Learn more at empower.msu.edu.
It's a knowledge-based economy going forward, and the place that trains the minds are our universities. The places that do the research that are really changing the world are the universities. And the universities are getting pinched. They're getting squeezed, especially the public universities, where the money coming in from the state is diminishing. 10 years ago, we got 70% roughly from the state of Michigan to cover tuition. Today, it's about 17%. So that gap has got to be covered, and costs are certainly not going down. So it takes the support of you know, a whole village to support someplace like a Michigan State, and they are really, really important to the future of this country.
There's more at givingto.msu.edu.
I'd like you to think about the difference you're going to make, because the dollars you're giving today in some cases will help the university today, but most of them will help the university for years and years to come. And that's hard to do.
I believe this job is about people, and I think he believes the same.
Bob Scandalaris has been as special a guy as I've known since I've been at Michigan State University.
I'm Russ White for MSU Today. Michigan State University alumna Susan Goldberg is the first woman to serve as editor-in-chief of National Geographic magazine, and she spoke to graduates at MSU's 2015 fall commencement ceremonies. She was honored to speak at her alma mater.
It's totally cool, and it's really something of a surprise because, you know, I dropped out of school for a while, and I always feel like I barely managed to graduate. So getting to come back, I did finally graduate, but getting to come back as the commencement speaker really is just a tremendous honor. I can't even tell you how much it means to me. I think MSU gave me the opportunity to succeed. You know, I had all the training I needed so that when somebody opened a door, I could walk through it and be successful. And I can never thank MSU enough for that training and for being able to take advantage of the opportunities that I've had.
Saying yes and taking smart risks are part of the message Goldberg hopes she left with the MSU grads.
I think the main one is say yes. Say yes to the things that scare you. Take bold chances. Take smart risks and understand that we are in a time of incredible change and turmoil. And that's not something to be afraid of. That's a great thing because out of all of this turmoil comes enormous opportunities.
Susan Goldberg has been editor of National Geographic magazine since April 2014. And she's just the 10th editor of the magazine since it was published in October 1888.
Well, so I'm the editor-in-chief of the magazine. Just in the last month, I'm also the editorial director for all five magazines that National Geographic publishes. I also run our books division, and I'm in charge of all of our digital content. So it's been a very, very busy time. You know, I've just changed jobs, expanded those responsibilities. But I've got to say, you know, one, we get to handle the most fascinating content in the entire world, so it's such a privilege. But also, I've got a tremendous team. You know, one person, you know, can't do it. You've got to do it by building great teams who are specialists in each area and who can help us be on the cutting edge of visual storytelling, digital storytelling, textual storytelling, every kind of storytelling.
The field of journalism and its business model have changed a lot over the years.
This industry has undergone enormous change in the last 20 years. Everything about how we gather and disseminate information has changed, but also the business model that supports our journalism has been very much affected in a negative way, and it is only just now starting to get rebuilt as we figure out how to monetize our content on digital platforms. But what I really think is great is we have the opportunity now to reach larger and more diverse audiences than we ever could have reached just through print before. So we're going to meet the readers and viewers where they are, and I'm happy to give people great National Geographic content any way they want to get it, whether that's Facebook or Snapchat or in the magazine or on our website or on, you know, streaming video.
So how do these changes impact students of journalism today?
I think people need to be flexible and keep adapting to the changes that are we are midstream on those changes. No way do I think those changes are going to stop. So be smart technically, but also make sure that they're great storytellers. In the end, we can always learn new ways to adapt to the technology, but in the end, it's going to be the people with the best ideas who are going to win, who understand how to powerfully tell stories using whatever is the latest method.
Goldberg established a scholarship at MSU, and she's a member of MSU's College of Communication Arts and Sciences Alumni Board of Directors.
Well, I thought it was important to establish a scholarship because so many students now are being forced really to take internships in which they are not paid, and that's going to be the only way they can get experience. I have to say, I really don't think that's a right thing, but I can't change the world. But what I can do is help those students by, you know, creating a scholarship that will give them stipends so they can take those internships. Otherwise, it would only be wealthy students who could get these internships where they're not paid, when in fact people, you know, lower-income kids, middle-income kids, everybody needs to learn the craft of journalism. And I just think that that needs to be something that everybody can participate in. I've gotten involved and stayed involved on the board just because I want to give back. I do feel like, as I said, that I got tremendous training. And I always have received more from MSU than I could ever get give back. So thanks. I am just so honored to be here.
Follow MSU alumna and National Geographic Editor-in-Chief Susan Goldberg on Twitter at Susan B. Goldberg. you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.